We're going to get to that. I'm glad we had a chance to let you talk a little bit. Let me just run down what we want to sort of get done today. All of us have worked together basically on this broadband stuff. Some of us as early as before the ARA got passed. Some of us, once it got passed, really focusing in on it. We've produced proposals. We've been in meetings with lots of different stakeholders, both from the state level to the city level. Ivy actually worked on one of the major reports out of CITI that went to the FCC. So there's a lot of, if you will, collective experience here that I think is important for us to sort of get a sense of where that is right now. We've seen who's been funded in the first round. And New York did get one, which I think is important. And we know that there's going to be sort of a lot of activity August, September, October, as they start to announce the second and final round of BTOP funds. And then some of the grants will be starting to get underway. So I just wanted to bring this group together to get a sense of how we think about all of that. And then also what we'll be doing is this first meeting is informal. It's not necessarily structureless, but it's not as formal as the next two, which actually will be reaching out to potential presenters. The idea is that the last meeting on the 29th of July, the city will be here. We hope to have Gail Brewer's office do it, Department of Ed, talk about their project. I'm also trying to reach out to a colleague at One Economy who got the huge final SBA grant, because part of that will happen in New York City. And then I've also reached out to some practitioners who we don't hear much about here in New York City, but are doing amazing work outside of New York, like Jabari Samama out of Atlanta, who's just wrote a major book called From Cyber Rights to Civil Rights. My colleague Andrew Cohill, who actually is wiring municipalities and doing it in such a way that the incumbents are clamoring to utilize his networks. So, you know, what I want to do is, where are some other models that might make sense what we're trying to do here in New York? And then Josh now has a new position at New America Foundation, which he'll talk about, where he's really been, he's not only been working with lots of different groups around the country, he's been monitoring this whole process. So he's a really, you know, helpful set of eyes and ears in Washington with the national kind of sense of what's going on. So that's the idea for today. And the idea was we have this sort of three sessions, 10:30, 11:30. We talk, get to know whom one another is, because this is all going to get covered. I want to give attribution to everyone as they make statements. This is probably someone trying to find this. And so what we want to do first, so the idea was first informal discussion, then we'll break for lunch, where we'll just go somewhere nearby and get sandwiches, come back, get a chance to sort of continue the conversation in a networking kind of way. And then the last hour or so, depending if it makes sense for us to stay through till 1:30, just sort of sense of next steps. But with an eye towards, we're sort of this co-producer group. So why don't we just jump into it right now? I also have a colleague who will join us by phone, Chuck Sherwood. I think you know Chuck. Chuck is very much involved in the whole space of community media and public media, which is another area we want to make sure is very well represented. And the idea is we're not going to get into sort of broadband telco issues on a large scale. We want to really talk about what are the community uses, the benefits, the applications that, you know, broadband can help us carry out. Hi, how are you? So what I'd like everyone to do is sort of introduce themselves, your full name, title, and your institutional affiliation.
Dr. John Clark, Acting Executive Director of Business and Industry Affairs for the City University of New York.
Amy Stern, independent consultant, and I wrote the BTOP grant for Mount Hope Housing Company.
Paul Guerin, founder of Wi-Fi NY.
Michael Preston, I work at the Columbia Center for New Media, teaching and learning here on campus.
Ivy Schultz, I'm a research associate here at CTIS.
Hi, my name is Carlos Barreja. I work with People's Production House. Joshua Breitbart, also at People's Production House, and I'm a field analyst with New America Foundation in D.C.
And I'm Bruce Lincoln. I'm the entrepreneur in residence at the Columbia School of Engineering here at the Center for Technology Innovation and Community Engagement.
Charlie McPhee, I'm the Secretary of the Internet Society, New York chapter.
Great. So what I'd like to do first is go around, and I'm going to go around this way this time, and just sort of in a very concise fashion, more than a minute, what do you feel is the most critical missing element as far as broadband at this point in time? And remember, our focus is on community broadband. Josh?
I have to pick one?
Well, start out with one for now. We're going to just...
The thing I think, you know, we had a meeting with the communications that we partnered with last night. It seems like one of the things that, and something that we've talked about in the America Foundation, is a lot more consumer awareness and what we call like a truth in billing when it comes to broadband, especially in a market like New York, where there are a lot of providers, you know, some that are starting up with new technologies, some that, you know, a number that have been around for a while. Seems like there's a lot of opportunity for efficiency and savings if we get some more awareness of what's available in the market and more tools for people to really judge what they're using and a way to match that together.
I would certainly have to agree with that. But I come from a background of public access television, so I feel like a big part of it is serving underserved communities for access to media, and this is where certainly people are engaging in sharing what's going on in their communities and also learning about how this is important to their organizing in their community. So I feel like access is certainly a key issue around this technology.
Ivy?
Oh, you can skip me for now.
Okay.
Skipping was an option?
Well, she's our rapporteur as well.
Bruce, I ran into Bruce. I go back to the ILT days with Bruce and have been working, supporting teaching and learning initiatives here on campus. So my involvement here is really just curiosity about this stuff. And we've been increasingly getting involved in community partnerships through our faculty clients at TC and other schools. So I just wanted to come and see what was going on.
Now, I'm going to call on you at some point, though, to represent that side of things as far as the broadband enabling education technology ideas that we've been talking about now for over 10 years.
Well, you asked Bruce what's missing, and I would say at this point is incentives for investors to put up funding. I think that's what's really missing, and what we need to how we need to address that, especially since the BTOP does not make any provision for startups, is to give incentives to angel investors, maybe some tax breaks or some kind of tax abatements. Especially when the infrastructure services are geared toward serving the unserved and underserved communities.
I think it's still the basic number of people that don't have computers, don't have training, and the phobias that come with it. In some cases, in most cases, it's financial, but there's also a set of people who are just afraid to touch the stuff, so that's where a lot of the training and mentoring comes in.
I was just in Brooklyn having the same conversation. We have 23 campuses, most in underserved neighborhoods. So I would say, Bruce, I mean, if you want to develop a theme, just be repetitive. It's access in the school and access in the home, the community.
So we're starting to, I think, show some patterns in terms of our thinking. Josh, let me go back to you. Why don't you elaborate some more on what you had begun, you know, saying earlier?
Which part about the truth and
that part, but also remember when I first asked you, said you had a lot of ideas of what you feel are missing. Why don't you start to elaborate on some of those?
Well, I think, you know, it really goes to what everybody was saying, and I think also what Carlos was talking about in terms of digital media and media production as a core skill. I think one of the things we're seeing is that, you know, because it's a read-write web or read-write world, that being able to produce media is really a critical skill. I mean, it's not the, you know, got to turn it on and use a mouse first, but if you don't get to the level of being able to add multimedia content you're going to have a sort of second-class presence on the internet.
Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, and our group is really focused on the use of media once it's been sort of produced, particularly for teacher training initiatives. We've been working with colleges and universities that are increasingly moving to kind of a distance engagement where mentors will observe practitioners in the field in social work or in teacher placements. And so the ability to deliver video in decent quality, to shoot it, upload it the same day, and have it shared among a group that might give timely feedback is becoming increasingly important in the work we're doing.
Where are you still running into issues of the digital divide in terms of your interactions with schools and the community?
You know, you really never know where stuff is going to work, of course. And it's become, thankfully, it's become much easier to produce video, you know, especially for the kind of timely but disposable stuff that we've been working on. But the ability to host and serve is really something that I don't think has even been adequately solved at a university like this one. And so opening up space and networks and the ability to just deliver stuff quickly has been a real problem.
So there's still a role that a Columbia University could fill beyond simply
Definitely.
Trying to put together sort of these sort of technical provisioning kinds of problems, really use content applications in a
right.
human service kind of?
We have the two endpoints, right? We know how to get video produced where it happens, and we know how to serve it, to deliver video through a web service where you can manipulate the content and share it meaningfully with people, but there's that middle component of the hosting and serving that is really kind of a pain in the neck for us.
Great. That's good stuff, Mike. I'm glad you were here to add that to the discussion. I want to introduce Plinio. Plinio, would you introduce yourself and your organization
Sure.
and some of your mission?
Well, thank you, Bruce. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. Many of you do know me. My name is Plinio Ayala. I'm the president of a not-for-profit organization in the Bronx called Perscolis. Our mission for the last 15 years has really been around trying to eliminate the digital divide in low-income communities, and the organization has evolved into sort of a number of different priority points. One around workforce development, so we train computer technicians every year to the tune of about 400 people a year, and then move them into the industry as full-time professionals. The second part of the operation is providing computers and digital literacy training to both low-income middle school youth and low-income seniors. We connect about 8,000 to 10,000 of individuals a year to computers. And then the last piece is a very green initiative where we recycle in an environmentally safe way the end-of-life material that no longer can be used, sort of e-waste. So the operation is a South Bronx, Brooklyn, and South Miami operation. We employ about 80 people through that operation. So there's another whole economic development piece to it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Just a few, and what we've just done is sort of gone through initial introductions, and then we've just gone through sort of 1.5 rounds of people sort of getting us a sense of what are they thinking? What are some of the issues? And Michael, also coming out of Education Guys, has introduced some other issues, which
mm-hmm.
I know you resonate with in terms of enabling educational technology
yeah.
advancement, things mm-hmm. such as that. John, from the perspective of CUNY, because you're both sort of a citywide institution, but also you tie into the state, where were the problems within how the BTOP stimulus plan was put together that in many ways made it difficult for you to address some of the initiatives that you had in mind?
Well, I mean, there's two problems. One is logistics. As you know, with the ERIC proposal, it's who we have to deal with as a public institution. I mean, there's a public trust, and that sounds very good, and it should be, in public accountability. But the number of agencies we have to deal with, the State Attorney General's office, we have to deal with the city office of the mayor, we have to deal with the state controller. So for us to even get to a point of responding to an RFP, we have to jump through the proverbial hurdles and make sure it's a priority. The other thing is resources. I mean, there is an exceptionally strong feeling at CUNY our two core missions are teaching and research and affordable. We see ourselves as the gateway with the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island out there internally. But that means we have restricted resources, but we also have a mission to the public. And that's a large economic development piece, especially, you know, Hostos in the South Bronx, Medgar Evers in Brooklyn. We feel we have a strong mission, and I think one of the challenges, and probably I like to see one of the formal sessions, is where are our resources? Because we're waiting for the axe to go. And there's a very active debate in CUNY and a lot of passion that you know, we have a long historic association with the Department of Education, with our campus schools and neighborhood schools. And this discussion on broadband, as I said, is absolutely critical to that. But with the new governor coming in and a multi-billion-dollar deficit, you know, how are we going to maintain our mission and teaching and research at the same time? So to us, it was a logistical discussion and a resource discussion. And the other third thing, I think, you know, you folks may be aware of, but I mean, there's been a sea change in Washington as far as, you know, funding opportunity announcements or RFPs. And if you saw the latest one with energy efficient housing we had, and we were working with Bruce and Jack McGordy here, there was Department of Commerce, Department of Energy, Small Business Association, National Science Foundation. We had six federal agencies all combined in one funding announcement opportunity in a silo, and then we had respond statewide. So the logistics on that, I was part of the Small Business Administration. Worthwhile projects, it was $122 million, but it was a very interesting exercise because you had to answer six RFPs that then had to be interconnected. So the logistics on this stuff as far as getting, and we found out Syracuse was the lead statewide, but we put together a coalition of state, city agencies, institutions of higher ed, not-for-profits trying to respond to this thing. Then we found out there were 30 to 40 competitors. And some of the funding, we had to answer the SBA piece, and I had worked with the State Small Business Development Corporation too, Empire State Development Corporation, NYSTAR ourselves in Columbia, and the award grant was $300,000 a year. And because New York had received an energy grant, that was reduced to $175,000, and there's 24 small business development centers across the state, so you do that math. But if we didn't answer that, the whole response to New York would be DQ'd. So trying to, that's just an example of where we are with broadband. It's, I mean, how do we get access to the resources? You know, where are the resources? And the last thing I'd like to end is, I did my master's thesis on Marx and Hegel, but the corporations have, and, you know, any, as far as providing resources, I mean, we have to be extremely selective, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, if we develop, because we see, you know, I grew up in an age in college where the industrial and military complex was at a very negative connotation. What we're seeing in the governor's task force is, you know, with Bruce, Columbia, NYU, statewide, is a higher ed industry government alliance, you know, where we can help each other because we're being forced to work with each other, which is probably a good thing on resources. Our feeling, as long as we, you know, are doing the right thing, producing, I guess what Dewey would call public good products. We're not going to make weapons of mass destruction. And who we're allying ourselves with. I mean, there might be a couple of firms down on Wall Street where I used to work where we don't want, for the time being, you know, maybe we'll take their money and play Robin Hood. But it's logistics and resources is probably our biggest frustration because this is part of our mission.
That's a good point you made, John, which I hadn't really thought about. In terms of the role the universities are playing in all of this. So not only do we have to get involved in broadband, we also have to get involved in every major initiative where there's potentially funding that might come into the city, which is also why it's important for us to have these broad-based relationships. You know, and we've been also working very closely with Perscolis because we needed to work with someone who, one, had a long-standing track record, is sustainable, and has a model that we know can work throughout the city. So what we're trying to do here is put together all the different pieces. So we need community media.
Right.
That door keep closing, excuse me.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the motivations for us, is that, you know, we saw that that the city was taking a lot of steps to address the needs of a lot of communities, but maybe not immigrant communities or some of the organizations we were working with. And, you know, frankly, it's not enough to just go to the city and say, oh, you need to do this. You know, we actually, it had to be in the form of actually putting together a proposal, putting together a coalition, and making it doable, not just a good idea.
And I think for some of the concerns we've expressed here, if I look at the FCC's 10-year plan on broadband, I think there's a real danger. Their focus seemed to be on getting more spectrum to wireless carriers, on smart grid, and on health IT. Those would have three big thrusts for the next 10 years. So not that can't help the constituencies we're concerned about, but it doesn't hit the mainstream of what we're concerned about. Clearly growing health IT can create some jobs for underserved people and so forth, and help with medical, but it's not going to get at the core issue we're all talking about of, you know, access for the underserved and training for the underserved. So I think we have to be concerned about that, you know, the kind of things we're concerned about and focused on here are not on the main hit list for the FCC's 10-year plan. So, you know, what does that mean? That means we either need to, you know, change the FCC a little bit, which is not easy to do, look for other sources in states and cities, or as Paul said, you know, somehow incentives for, you know, private investment. But we need to do something, knowing that we're coming up against a public policy direction that's kind of not really focused on the broader underserved community interest.
Amy, Bruce and I have talked about this. Do you see, and nothing against rural areas, but an emphasis from the feds on the rural areas as opposed to urban areas that are underserved?
Yes, I think, I mean, just anecdotally, I haven't tallied up the numbers, but it seems to me like there's a lot more money going to the rural areas.
Well, that also has to do with the repurposing of the universal service charge on the phone bill from the phone POTS service to broadband. And actually, it's a good thing, I believe, that they did repurpose that and that it's going to go that way. And, you know, of course, in the rural areas, they don't have the economics of scale we do in the more dense urban areas. So it does cost more per link out there and per node. So that's one issue. Well, some of the things I see here, though, and what I heard from you, too, is the trouble we have are a couple of things. Is first of all, the bureaucracy and the speed at which things need to move. And with this grant funding RFP system, I think it's just going to slow things down. With respect to the FCC, we don't have to wait for the FCC to do anything. I think actually we have a lot of leeway and there's a lot of possibilities to do things today. Mm-hmm. Really what's stopping it is just basically resources and funding and the getting the right models to make that happen. Because all the types of equipment, all the logistical methods are there. We don't have to have additional spectrum necessarily. There's a lot of things we can do now to build, I mean, really, literally now, to build the infrastructure out with existing equipment under existing rules. And really the question it really comes down to is the capital. And one of the things also is because with all these grants, I mean, I'm not coming from the academic world, so I'm not used to this public funding model. You know, I had it a little bit in the arts in the 80s and 90s when I was a practicing media artist, but as an entrepreneur, a social entrepreneur, my focus has been in how to shift the ownership into the community itself by creating this kind of localism, stakeholder model, where we, instead of having to raise large blocks of capital, say from banks or whatever, that smaller investments can be made on a per building or per node basis using private agreements and individual funding on a member basis. That can actually help it grow. This is the way to accomplish this, I found, is really just through education and outreach and creating an awareness. But the legal structures exist, the technical methods exist, and the will exists, actually, to actually make this happen. And I think that if we wait for the policies and the paperwork, we're going to be 10 or 20 years out. We're not going to see this happen. So not to be pessimistic about it, but I was personally daunted when I went to the workshop for the BTOP funding at the state office building a couple of months ago, because there was absolutely no place for small startups. And also, they weren't taking into account infrastructure and affordability. And I think this is really severely lacking. So really where the focus has to be is we have to really look back to our communities.
Do you think that some of the steps that the city is taking to help startups, are those more focused on digital media?
The city's idea of a startup is to give people a little office space and internet connectivity. That's not about creating a sustainable infrastructure. You understand? So, giving somebody an office isn't going to help them build a network. So when I went to the EDC hearings at the end of 2009, I thought it was great. And there are a lot of people who can benefit from that. If they want to put up a website, to put information where your parking meter is or whatever it is, that's fine. But if you want to really address the issue of infrastructure to underserved and unserved communities, it's not going to help to have an incubator in downtown.
Let's take a break there. We've been joined by some other guests, so I'd like them to have a chance to introduce themselves. Let's start with Simo. Simo's actually visiting from Helsinki.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. So I'm Simo Vastinen. I'm a researcher at an independent think tank in Finland called Demos Helsinki, and we focus on social topics. So this is all very exciting, and I met up with Bruce a couple weeks ago, and I want to come by again to hear some more about this initiative, which is linking to several of our projects. We've been dealing a lot with the changing nature of work and labor, and also with we're working also together with a company called MicroTask Limited, and so our main topics at Demos are well-being, low carbon lifestyle, motivation, and cities of the future, basically. So, but yeah, it's all connected.
Hi, my name is Leon Thurman. I'm a recent transplant, or semi-transplant from South Africa. Being head of the Mobile Industry Association there, and involved in micropayments. I'm currently doing my doctorate on mobile payments law. Trying to find a methodology to allow cell phones to be used as mobile payments devices, specifically for poor, or I should say the underbanked in Africa, which would allow money transfer over wireless networks from point to point within Africa or even from outside Africa. I'm also involved in some structures as far as value-added services in South Africa and possibly in New York.
Have you been working with the Mo Ibrahim Foundation?
No.
Yeah, because I know that they have a similar interest in what you're doing.
Yeah, I was in Nairobi, in so many places in the past few weeks. Nairobi about a week or two ago, and I met them there, and they have been involved in that. But Gates Foundation, a whole lot of organizations see this as the future. Mm-hmm. CGAP, World Bank, IFC, DFID, and this is the way of empowering people, because without access to finance or information with Africa, you really don't come out of the pre-modern era. So that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at, I've just done a project for the Kenyan government on helping to write a law to assist in mobile payments. There's a big system there which they pioneered in Kenya called M-Pesa, which you might have heard of, which has expanded on various incarnations around the world. Various mobile operators and service providers and the like are doing various incarnations thereof. But Kenya has been the progenitor of this kind of service, started in 2005 with microfinance, paying back microfinance and loans, and eventually have evolved into micropayments and money transfer. So Kenya is seen as the bellwether of where this all is, and that's what I've been working on.
Cal.
Hi, I'm Calvin Norman. I'm here mostly because I've known Bruce forever. I'm a digital media consultant. I'm one of those guys who works with the startups, trying to figure out how to make money with distribution and advertising, that sort of stuff. So I thought it was just a very interesting thing to see how this is pervading the stage of the game.
So why don't we just step back a little bit, sort of as a recap, and then for those who just came, to throw out what the general idea is again. So Ivy and I were sort of trying to think about what would be the best way to use what Columbia can do in this sort of interim period. We've all written proposals, we've all tried to organize groups, we've all gotten mad at the BTOP program, we've all, but where does that place us at this point in time now that the first round is complete and the funding has been committed? The City of New York will be receiving one of the largest sustained broadband adoption grants, $22 million, to do a project with the Department of Education, DOIT, and the focus is on getting public middle school kids internet access, educational technologies, software training, and to address the digital divide in that very specific way, which anyone who's been in this for a long time knows that was a very popular model 10 years ago. So that's kind of says something about the state of the digital divide if we're still having to look at those kinds of models, and those models make sense when we're just trying to address access. One of the things we want to do here is look at what are the really important applications, and not simply on the rhetorical level of distance education and healthcare and the other things they always talk about, but where does it meet the needs of people on the ground here in a city as diverse in New York? And how do we bring together all of our ideas so that it ultimately equals some level of coherent, coordinated technology strategy that goes beyond access, that looks at some of these low-cost engineering solutions, such as what Paul is saying, and they might meet the needs of a large-scale institution that touches the lives of every underserved community in not only the city but the state, and then who was dunned from submitting a proposal because supposedly in all those communities there's broadband access, which goes back to just how the stimulus funding was written. And some of that we can understand, but still, we're committed to making sure that there's this ubiquitous access for a lot of social values that we all don't even question. And so why don't we sort of move into this next round where perhaps we might look more at what are the compelling applications that really can drive broadband? And one of the things that I want to do here is get from where we solve the technological issues to where we come up with a sustainable model. And I want us to think some about the telework model that now Proskolis is looking. And Proskolis as well looks at this as a social venture, that this is a social enterprise that requires this level of collaboration to make it sustainable. And where we don't have the finances, we definitely have to have all the key institutions involved and supportive of this. Do you want to talk a little about where you guys are at this point, Plinio?
You know, throughout this whole BTOP process, I think one of the biggest questions that I'm not sure many applicants answered was the issue of sustainability. And I think, Paul, you've got a wonderful model. What happens after the funding is gone? How do you make sure that programs stay vibrant? The teleworks model, I think, allows us to do that. I think it creates really the new and improved community technology center where a whole bunch of services are provided to the community, but there is a social venture aspect attached to it so that when funding goes away, it creates a level of sustainability for that program. And what we're looking at is launching a digital document transfer business that allows us to create jobs in the South Bronx, trains individuals to assume those jobs, but obviously creates a level of revenue that will help support this whole community technology center going forward. There, I think, are unique opportunities within the city to launch something pretty aggressive in that area. And I think that aligning ourselves with all types of different aspects of the community, and the educational system, partners like CUNY, the corporate community, which can help in a number of areas, and the foundation of the not-for-profit community, sort of understanding that in order to launch something like this, we need assistance from all aspects of the community. But clearly the model is to be able to launch an initiative that can be sustainable long-term.
We've been joined by Chuck Sherwood. Say hi, Chuck.
Hey, how is everybody?
Chuck, tell us a little about your background. And Plinio just talked about the importance of having telework as a sustainable model. And after you talk about yourself and some of what you're doing, talk about how the community and public media part of that wraps around the telework and the broadband deployment.
Sure. For about the last 35 years, I've been kind of playing in this space, starting off as one of the co-founders of Channel R Working Group, which was the original government access operation for the city of New York from Manhattan, starting in the late 70s, and then have gone on to be executive director of various public access entities, first in Cincinnati and then on Cape Cod. A lot of people don't quite understand that access centers are, in fact, telework centers where we basically train people in the use of the technology in order to create content that's either distributed on access channels on cable systems or through the internet, but also these access centers are actually pathways to learning because we work with kids in the schools, we work with adults who are going through cross-training, we give them basically skill sets that they can then go ahead and get more training in educational institutions that then lead to work. More recently, the work that I've been doing is really kind of pushing the whole concept because I have my undergraduate degrees in government and I worked in planning, regional planning, is the importance of telecom infrastructure for community educational and economic development. Here on Cape Cod, I really have been the kind of the nudge that finally led to folks here getting funded in round one of the BTOP for Open Cape, which is going to be a middle mile network. It originally started off as a concept several years ago that it would be wireless, and I kept reminding folks you can't have wireless without wireline. And so that's what it eventually transformed itself into, is a some 300-mile fiber network, middle-mile network for the Cape, the islands, and southeastern Massachusetts, connecting into Providence and to Boston. And so we're in the process now of getting everything set up and all of that. More recently, I was part of a team that worked with Methodist hospitals in Northwest Indiana, and we submitted a round two middle mile network proposal that would then go ahead and link together the three campuses of the hospital, three municipalities, Gary, Indiana, Merrillville, Indiana, and Crown Point, which is the county seat. 157 anchor institutions, all the schools, all the town halls, all the municipal buildings, access centers also there, and then would be involved in creating content and training people. So the whole issue that Bruce likes to call telework, I also refer to as community media centers, because it's you know, we have to really think about broadening the concept of what kind of skill sets people learn in these centers, and so that's kind of a lot of the work that I've been doing. I also am very involved with various national organizations, the Alliance of Community Media, the National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, and have just been in the process for the last couple of months of being the guest editor for an upcoming issue of Community Media Review, which basically has as a focus community media centers connecting with the new broadband networks. And so there's a whole series of articles in there specifically around the issue of sustainable adoption. And there's some really interesting examples of that kind of work going on here in Massachusetts. And so I can talk about that kind of stuff in future meetings.
Great, thanks. I want to ask another question.
Yeah.
To kind of rapidly push you to this, so we broach that here. The National Broadband Plan is not a strategic technology plan. It is a set of potential directions and influences. What do we do with something such as that, and what do you think are the concrete steps we need to take so that we start to push towards some level of strategic national technology plan?
Well, you know, keep in mind that the national broadband plan that has been put forth by the FCC is just the first step in this process. It doesn't really go as far and as I would like to have seen it go, nor is it as comprehensive as it should be. Because, once again, this is not just about infrastructure, but it's also about connecting places with applications. And needless to say, you don't really get any of that within the NBP. So, you know, I think that there needs to be parallel work, and I was really delighted when Bruce called me some weeks ago to talk about this idea of having Columbia be the place where folks could come together and really start talking about how do we come up with an actual comprehensive, collaborative, national broadband plan that is not just about infrastructure, but about needs and services and the places where these skill sets can be provided so that we can, in fact, have a 21st century plan that makes sense in an information and innovation economy.
Great. Thanks, Chuck. What we're going to do once again now is step back because we've been joined by another guest. So once again, we're going to go around and quickly introduce ourselves. You'll understand this madness because once you start cutting video and all this stuff, it all helps. So I'm Bruce Lincoln, and I'm entrepreneur in residence here at Columbia University School of Engineering. And I'll go in this.
I'm Plinio Ayala, and I'm the president of a not-for-profit organization with main offices in the South Bronx called Perscolis, and we've been dealing with the issue of the digital divide in low-income communities for the last 15 years.
John Clark, acting executive director of business and industry affairs for the City University of New York.
Amy Stern, I'm an independent consultant. I do telecommunications consulting and grant writing. I did a BTOP grant for Mount Hope Housing Company.
I'm Paul Guerin, founder of Wi-Fi NY, a local community-based social enterprise network and alternative last-mile provider serving Lower East Side and parts of Brooklyn.
I'm Michael Preston. I work for the Columbia Center for New Media Teaching and Learning here on campus. We make web applications for teaching primarily at the university level, but also extending into communities and schools, including a lot of work on video analysis and putting media tools in the hands of students.
My name is Daryl Cuba. I'm a social and digital media strategist and very interested in the tech world here in New York. I'm very new to the city and something about grad school.
I'm Calvin Norman. I'm an internet business consultant, basically specializing in business development and advertising.
I'm Ivy Schultz. I'm a research associate here at Columbia Engineering and the Center for Technology Innovation.
Hi, my name is Carlos Pareja. I work with People's Production House. Used to work with BCAT, so hey, Chuck. And I'm here representing People's Productions, yes.
I'm Joshua Breitbart. I'm a field analyst with New America Foundation.
I'm Leon Cohen. I'm the head of the Mobile Industry Association in South Africa and in the governor's mobile patents.
And I am Simo Lassen, a researcher from think tank Demo Helsinki in Finland. I'm in New York for a couple of months doing some research and writing. And yeah, our main themes are democracy, participation, active communities, so on. And I'm here to hear more about the project and maybe pinpoint some possible points.
And we've also been joined by
Clayton Banks. Nice. Company, media. I think we've got a few people around here, which is good to see some familiar faces.
We have Chuck Sherwood on the phone.
Hey, Chuck.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, good, good.
All right, so I'm going to recap, then we're going to go into what will be sort of our next sort of half hour, and then we'll break for lunch, then where folks can, you know, get lunch and network and some. So what we just did, Clayton, was we sort of had three rounds of sort of people's introductions with the affiliation and then their kind of stamp on broadband. Then we broadened that out where people have elaborated some on their general take on where broadband is, their experience dealing with the realities of the stimulus funding. We've alluded to the importance of New York City having won funding through the Department of Ed and tied to Gail Brewer's office, who of course are also supportive of this series. And then we got into a little bit about some of the applications from micropayment and working with the underbank, such as what Leon's doing in South Africa and how that applies to our communities, to some of the issues of a CUNY where they've got sort of a public mandate, but they also have a large-scale institution where there's lots of stakeholders that have to get involved in that, to some of the telework model ideas of Prescolis. And so why don't we take this next half hour to sort of think sort of innovatively about what we think should happen if each of us equals a component of what will be, if you will, a truncated strategic technology plan for the city of New York. What would that entail? And let it capture your organization, but also your constituency. So for instance, Paul, you've got your gigabit speed wireless network that works, but if we scaled it naturally to reach the Lower East Side, how do we do that? What's that need? Does that explain sort of what I'm getting at? You know, and we can, you know, go at it again. But the general idea is I represent this. I think the next state of what I'm doing is X, and to get there, we need to do Y and Z. Clayton, why don't you start out since you just got here from your standpoint?
Well, a couple of things. One is I pretty much represent
a couple of angles. One is technology, two is content, three is portal development, to the extent that all of these various outreach efforts and distribution as well as access issues that are being discussed and part of the broadband vision. I'm also, I have models that help with the sustainability and the actual monetization of all of our grand broadband viewpoints. And I think that's one of the things that I want to bring to the table. I think it's essential to the government to the extent that they have another round of stimulus in 2012 or later, because one of the things that, you know, obviously we'll all be discussing is after this stimulus runs out, where are we? And so sustainability is one of those things that has been built into stimulus, but I think there's also sustainability that's incumbent on us as private companies. So that's where my company comes into play. From a content perspective, from a portal development perspective, and essentially from a monetization and model for that perspective. And it can range everything from nonprofit telework centers to full citywide efforts. So where I think the next step is, for us, we have been attaching ourselves to a variety of efforts and we haven't been lucky enough to get a stimulus approval, but we continue to move forward on the private side and working a lot with our other private companies and along with the, where I think a lot of the revenue can start to mean something in years to come will be how we, you know, combine public and private efforts, particularly in the advertising and brand area where these companies want to be associated with good efforts. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Amy, would you like to speak from your standpoint? And you can represent Mount Hope and some of the things that they're trying to accomplish.
Okay, I think Mount Hope is trying to get at all the different facets of the population in their community. So they're looking at young people, trying to get them not only computer access, but training. They're looking at the, what they call tweenagers, the, you know, young teenagers, trying to do a couple of different things with them. One, similar to Prescolis, I think what Prescolis is doing is trying to teach younger people, train them enough so that they can become trainers in turn and go out to the rest of the community and train others, go into homes of older people, for example, disabled people. They're working directly with some older adults. They're working with unemployed and underemployed. So Mount Hope views itself as kind of an overall community developer, you know, going holistically after a lot of different segments in the community. It's all not-for-profit, so it's all, you know, through grants and donations, but they are looking towards building a sustainable model and having things like telework centers and maybe some, you know, services that charge fees, etc.
I want to also just get a sense, so everyone here knows, the expertise you bring to bear, because you know, were a very helpful member of that one meeting we had trying to get a collective bill. Speak to the importance of why it's why we need to collaborate, and especially from the standpoint, say, of a Mount Hope, who brings certain strengths, but they also have certain places where they could, you know, tie into more capacity.
I think several reasons, all of them very practical, why we should collaborate. One, I think from a political perspective, you know, if we go in as a larger group and more organized, I think for the most part, you know, regulators, legislators, and managers who disperse funds will pay more attention to a larger group with a cohesive plan. I don't think they want to see overlaps. I think they'd rather see us go in together instead of having separate entities trying to do the same things, potentially overlapping in the same geographies. I think they're just economies of scale. When you do it larger, there's better purchasing power, whether you're talking about buying PCs, whether you're talking about purchasing internet access, or in things like training, you can share best practices. So I think this is an area where there are some real economies of scale and efficiencies to be gained by joining in as a larger group.
Thanks, Amy. That's very helpful. Carlos, give us your take on the things that you've heard.
Well, I think we had a meeting yesterday with a lot of the different People's Production House members, and I'm hearing actually from some folks here about, you know, the strength of numbers and going certainly in there as a group is something that's going to be, I think, more effective in having legislators and regulators here it from the perspective of the grassroots. And what was inspiring about last night was just listening to our partners and hearing what they are, when they're right at the ground level engaging with people in the community and really hearing what's going on, what their needs are. And it is something like Josh was saying before about like pricing and just being a little bit more understanding about how that affects access, how people are also using it as for the different organizations that they're working with. There was an organization that works with us, like vendors, but their streetcars are, they...
Street carts?
Yeah, street carts. And they, something that I learned was that a lot of their licensing, a lot of their information is on the web. So they can't even, you know, be in compliance with what the regulations are to be a street cart vendor unless they do have access to the internet. So there's a lot of stories that we're hearing about how this, the granular stories about how people are really needing this technology. So I think that is something that our organization is spending quite a lot of effort to do, is to really go out and gather media about what the different stories are, make a compelling case for why this is something that's important and not just, you know, more bandwidth for just the sake of having more bandwidth or more channels on the dial, you know, like that kind of stuff that often gets considered of what choice is in this era of having access. So I see that what we'll be doing for quite a bit, it's going to be a process, and we're just going to have to take the time to engage our communities to find out what that is, so that we can come with knowledge about how this will break down on a practical level to folks who are, you know, legislating this in terms of like, you know, net neutrality or other, you know, broadband, universal broadband, and other larger issues that might not really make
sense. How many organizations were at your meeting last night, just so we get a sense of your...
Well, I know there was 21 that were part of the BTOP proposal, but I would say there were probably like 16 or 17 organizations. Most of them came yesterday, so it just really speaks to how
great
this is, very, very important to their work.
Great. Now, you need to reintroduce yourself.
Okay. I'm Daryl Cuba. I'm new to the city, and I'm sort of a social and digital media strategist and consultant for different corporations and nonprofits. And again, I'm just here to actually learn.
So have you been looking at some of the broadband stimulus, or are you more focused on the startup space?
I've been in the startup space and sort of trying to branch out to broadband technology and policy.
Great. John, how do you see all this, and where are some concrete places where we can make a difference?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to thank Bruce for convening this, and also, just to blow Bruce's horn some more, Iterate Conference with IBM. I mean, I hear what I'm hearing all over the place is, in a time of challenging economic circumstances, we need to get together. and the old silo is a negative word. People, you know, like with Mount Hope, I was involved with Crotona for years in the South Bronx. People tend to focus on their own issues, and we really need to expand horizons to bring in, as we've been talking about here, a coalition and see where all the pieces fit. What Columbia can do, what the City University of New York can do, what the not-for-profits can do. And we have to look for every stone and rock, and somewhere, even in these times, we have to keep positive and we have to find resources. They're there, even though which way the stock market goes. And there's always Fed money. I don't think there's any state money, but we keep asking. You know, corporate money, but again, you know, we have to make a decision as a group, you know, how we approach that in a very positive fashion. And it's a real solid network and alliance where everybody's agreed on goals, next steps, and we have to be very clear. And in times like this, I think one of the problems is people have different, I mean, agenda in a neutral sense, is where do we all work together? How do we work together? And people have different talents. Some people are great at political skills, like who can we get support, whether it's Gail Brewer, do we get some, you know, state senate, assembly, or federal from our local congressional delegations. Other people on substance, context, and then what do we want to do? What's our goals and next steps, you know, in the educational, in the community sense? I think we can multitask, but if it gets too diluted, I know I've seen groups come together, do some wonderful things. You know, for example, in South Bronx, I was part, a very small part, in the housing revolution where we were stuck. It was the old, you know, Paul, as you were talking, you'd have to fund, I'm allergic to the word seed money. Because, you know, after a year of a pilot project, the money's gone and we're stuck. The revolution is one night, nobody wanted to be a landlord. And somebody said, has anyone heard of, this is a long time ago, Bruce. Anybody heard of a co-op? No, how do we do that? But that empowered the community where we were selling in concert with the city, you know, renovating buildings. And we empowered the people, saying, you now are going to be a co-op owner for $200, you get a two-bedroom, you get a three-bedroom for $300, and you're our boss. And that was some amazing meetings with looks like, and I think here what we're talking about is a grassroots organization. And, you know, and the other thing I think, Bruce, maybe in a follow-up meeting, if you want an organizational meeting, is doing an inventory. So you can point to me and say, John, what can, you know, CUNY do? You know, Paul, Amy, you know, where do we fit and where we don't fit and what this group is about? And you may say, John, that's great what CUNY's doing, but it's not really on the margins. And that would be my suggestion.
Great. Chuck, do you want to weigh in?
Everything that I'm hearing makes me feel really good. You know, as a planner, I have always understood that you can't do something that's not comprehensive, collaborative, and cooperative. You know, those are the three things that makes all of this work. And particularly when you're dealing with broadband infrastructure, then the whole point is not just to connect all the anchor institutions in your community, but then have all of those anchor institutions be connected with all the other anchor institutions, whether it's in your region, your state, the nation, the planet. You know, that's what this is all about, and this is great to hear folks talk about this. And not just connectivity, but also services. And what applications can we develop for community educational and economic development? And what facilities need to be put in place in order, what places need to be there, whether they're schools or access centers or community technology centers? We have to really start thinking holistically, and that's what this is all about.
Calvin, I want to get your take from your having been involved in this from the private standpoint. You've been involved with a number of startups, but you were involved early on with some of the early online advertising and saw a lot of the broadband stuff happen here in this city. where do you sort of see this as, say, a driver for the kind of economic growth you know the city wants to stimulate through startup development?
Oh, I just pick up on what he's been saying about applications, you know, because a lot of it is, let's face it, you're laying down a lot of pipes and you're trying to get access to people. And, you know, with that access, you've got to have a draw for people finding the utility. And they've got to see some practical usage, you know, and ideally it's beyond just the surfing the web and looking at porn and that sort of thing. You know, it's got to be something that, you know, in an ideal world is an enhancement to their lives. And, you know, that's sort of the opportunity. In my mind, it's parallel to all this development of applications for cell phones at this stage of the game. You know, and trying to drive it, the buzzwords that are going on across the board these days, it's very much, everything is very socially media-based. And trying to empower people to be the drivers of the connections they're making among themselves. I think that combined with this idea of applications, in the sense that, you know, you've got to have practical stuff, educationally based, you know, give me a means to figure out how to make some more money or how to learn the things that I need to make a living. I think part of it goes down the path of, you know, healthcare. You know, I'm concerned about, you know, taking better care of myself, give me access to more means of doing that sort of thing. You know, it's expanding on the teleworks market in various different directions. That's where the opportunity lies. I think that's the opportunity to drive demand for, I've got to have these services, I've got to have this access. You know, that's my two cents.
If I could jump in, I would also say that I just got back from the cable show, which was out in LA last week, and talking with Les Moonves and Brian Roberts and Jeff Bukas, the heads of, you know, these major entertainment organizations, but are relying primarily on broadband infrastructure to run their businesses, right? Cable company is relying on the backbone in order for all of us to receive this, whether we're an institution or a private house or apartment. And I will tell you that they had absolutely no vision of the future. So it is, but what I do realize is that the demand on the backbone is, I think, being underrepresented, and that the delivery of services, applications, and access is exponentially growing, largely due to video content. As we get into more and more porting our HD content onto the backbone, it is going to be a tremendous issue. And I think that, you know, a lot of people are underestimating that kind of drag on the backbone. But I think the opportunity within that is things like a shared job training video library, where Mount Hope can pull from the library and Prescolas can pull from the same library.
Or add to it.
And I think these kinds of virtual libraries can be a service to the community as well as even to the private sector, which allows it to be monetized. So there's ways that I think we're gonna have to look at private-public partnerships to monetize whatever the application or service is, so in order for it to be sustained. But the other collective thing that, you know, that we need to do, Chuck, is to make sure that the backbone is also being built in a way that can handle the traffic, the video traffic that's going to be coming in, as Calvin said, the social media traffic, which is also quite demanding when people are sharing files back and forth and with several people. Both locally and internationally.
That's why backbone's got to be fiber.
Absolutely.
But I think as long as the backbone is oversubscribed, which it is right now in most areas I think that will take care of itself because the Verizons of the world are going to keep building as long as they see demand out there, and demand is skyrocketing. I think it will get to a point, though, where the backbone becomes oversubscribed once again, undersubscribed once again, and overbuilt, because these things go in cycles. You know, the capital investment is in bunches, you know, and there's a big jump, and then usage has to keep up. And that's where we should be, if you talk about collaborative efforts, we should be ready to jump in with a large subscriber base, a lot of uses and applications. You know, after they finish building and there's a lot of excess capacity, that there'll be a moment in time when people are going to listen to us because we'll have what they value, which is a large subscriber base, large number of applications and users to fill up the slack in capacity. Right now we're kind of at the other end of the cycle, where capacity is tight, but it's a good time to start getting ready for, you know, 2 years out when the backbones are overbuilt again. And you can jump in and get more attention and do more partnership things at that point.
I agree with what you're saying. I would just add that in coming back from at least talking to some of these moguls, their interest in services and nonprofit and that type of stuff is really low on their radar. They are very much focused on, you know, of course, entertainment and social media and the things that they can make money off of. And I think it's incumbent upon us to push that agenda and not wait for cycles. It's just really got to push it up on their agenda, but make a business case so that they see that this is something that's worth investing in. Because I think the capacity is there also. But we've got to make sure that they see a business case to invest in. Why should we allow for virtual libraries on our bandwidth? That's just a bandwidth hog. I want to meter that, or I want to charge you for that. And we get into all types of issues around that.
I want to talk to two points, and it comes back to the pragmatics, because as an entrepreneur, I always have to look at economics and sustainability. And one thing is I can say is most of the incumbent carriers, when they deal with the broadband, they're dealing with it as a service and not as a commodity. And I think what we need to do, and what I've been giving a lot of thought about, is when I look, for example, what Germany did with solar power, is the way they did financing was they created a 30-year finance cycle where they put an investment for a certain amount of capacity, and then they created a price stability over time. I believe we can do the same thing with broadband infrastructure, and we need to. So we have to think about it, especially in terms of community media and local ownership of that media infrastructure, where we can create a financing model where we can plan. It takes, of course, very good planning and not to underestimate capacity. And I don't think overbuilding is a good thing. I mean, it's a bad thing, rather. I think it's actually a good thing. Because once you build a large amount of capacity and you look at that as a long-term investment into the future, you can create price stability. And I think this is what needs to happen in order to bring the wholesale price down. Because right now, wholesale price for bandwidth is still high. It outstrips actually the price point, what a carrier is able to buy and then resell. That's why you're getting these issues about the net neutrality and bandwidth hogging and all these other kind of things. So to create a model where bandwidth is treated as a commodity and not a service is the first step. Then services to run on that are low overhead in terms of fixed costs but high revenue generating. And I'm going to step back to the top level domain issue now too, because this is something I've been working on for 16 years and needs to stay here in New York City, because the numbers, when I ran at Pace University last year, what our projections would be on a portfolio of 100 top-level domains that Name.Space created in the 90s and we've been trying to bring into the market, a reasonable projection would be that there's a $200 million annual profit, recurring revenue. So the fixed cost of the capacity of the infrastructure that it costs to run that allows for that kind of high profit. And then also there's a surplus of infrastructure where there can be other services provided on the clouds and clusters of the compute, you know, the data center resources that would be available running this. And then also in our hands, if we keep this here and don't let it go to Australia or Canada or New York or, I mean, Virginia, if we can have this domain services running here out of New York City, there can also be a public good which is lacking. In fact, the top-level domain wholesale business is one of the most, the least known, least understood, and most profitable in the entire internet industry. If you look at it, all the companies that are doing the top-level domain wholesale are really seriously in the red. I mean, in the black, right? For every $1 million of investment, there's at least a 4 to 6 time return on that investment. And in the most of the big companies' hands, none of them are contributing back any public good. And a lot of people, you guys are coming from the public access media model, where the funding for cable TV, cable access, comes from the franchise fees. We don't have an analog to that in the internet. So in my view, I believe that the domain name fees that are paid could and should be contributed back as a public good. In my case, if name.space were to be successful, I would set that up voluntarily. And you know, I think that anyone who invests in our company would see that it's a good thing to do that, because of all the intangibles that grow from that. You know, the training that happens, the new talent that emerges, the other types of spin-offs that can happen that you can't plan, but that you can have the resources for in a sustainable way. So if I want to argue my case, for those who aren't aware about it, look up name.space and look at the history of the project, and you will see what impact it'll have if we can keep this here in New York, and why it's important that we do so.
I think my comment is a little bit of a non sequitur from where this conversation is headed the last couple of turns, but maybe related to what Clay was saying earlier. I wanted to provide a kind of a case experience of what we're doing right now here that is a public and private thing around a specific need that we identified and that came out of work that was being done in video-based learning research at Columbia and early childhood workforce preparation work that we're doing at Teachers College related to STEM education. And then we had developed a pilot project here to do early math training to the teachers who will do preschool, kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. And through that had developed this sort of video-based system where the teachers, the pre-service and current teachers, would have a way to access a library of video, high-quality video that we shot with NSF money, of what it's like, what children at those ages are like, how to teach them, what they understand based on cognitive science, et cetera. And then together with our technology, we could kind of deliver a course system. So now we are developing a pilot project with CUNY schools, in fact, in partnership with deans and faculty at BMCC in Queensborough on the community college level, and then Lehman and CCNY on the four-year college level, to kind of distribute this technology in the courses to them and allow them to both use the library of videos, manipulate that content online, also shoot their own videos of teaching and working with children and contribute those to the library and use them as objects of analysis, and then create this model basically that we can try and disseminate citywide and actually have a real impact on how early childhood education looks in the city, ranging from Head Start through early classrooms in the New York City public school system. So that's something that we're trying to get going now, and I think would benefit from some sort of capacity building to make us really get those partnerships going. So.
Great.
What stage are you at with that project? Like, is it fully deployed, or
it's happening on a, well, it happens fully at Columbia because that's sort of where we already operate. But the partnerships with the CUNY schools are just fledgling at this point. We have two faculty members at each of those four schools I mentioned, and we're working with them to get their courses started. We haven't gotten funding for a new round of funding yet from NSF, and hope to.
Who's involved from the private sector?
from the private side. Well, by private, I meant private-public, meaning private university versus public university partnership. We don't have any sort of investment from the outside, and that's sort of a space we haven't navigated yet. And maybe you could use some guidance for understanding how to make that work.
We should talk offline.
Great.
Anyone else have some final comments they'd like to make before we break for lunch? Leon? How do you see what's going on in Africa as far as how it compares to what we're trying to achieve with broadband, you know, creating equity in underserved communities here?
Well, you know, you've got a mixture of both worlds here. You've got infrastructure. You don't have that in Africa. You don't have electricity in a lot of cases. And really what's happened there is a kind of a leapfrogging environment. I'll speak for South Africa, for example. All the sidewalks right now have been pulled up to lay fiber. And in the absence of fiber, they're using WiMAX, and also 3G at 900 megahertz is a new evolution, because a lot of the networks are at 2.1 gigahertz. So 900 has got better range. You've got about, I don't know, what's it, miles, about 10 miles range versus 5 miles range on 2.1 gig. So the economies of scale become better to the 900 megahertz. So you've got a mixture there. People trying to roll out fiber in the cities and WiMAX and 900 megahertz 3G in the rural areas. So prices are slowly coming down. What's been a problem is the fact that there's been a monopoly on undersea cables, which is 90%, I believe, is the traffic within Africa, goes out of Africa. So it's your Facebooks and the, you know, YouTubes and the like. So that's where the cost is. The cost is less internal to Africa and more external. And the monopoly on that has been broken with the CECOM and safe cables being broken. So prices are coming down to the extent we're actually now seeing flat rate pricing, unlimited bandwidth in some cases. Slightly throttled, choked, but it's changing the environment because, you know, sitting there, I used to sit and watch the throttle, so to speak, and see if my 3 gigabyte per month cap was being reached, and then switch you off. I mean, it's not economically viable. You're going to get switched off mid-month. So that kind of restriction is now slowly ameliorating as competition in the undersea cable environment evolves.
Seema, what are some of the similarities that you see in terms of the things that we've discussed here, and how does it resonate with some of the things that you're seeing in Helsinki or elsewhere where you, mm-hmm. you know, are doing your think tank work?
Well, it resonates a lot, but I've now been in New York for about 5 weeks, and I'm obviously it's very different social issues that we're dealing with. That if you compare downtown Helsinki to Harlem, it's, you know, different, a lot of different issues that we're dealing with. But then I think where it ties in more is on the, like, the behavioral models and community development in general and participation, which I personally have a pretty non-technical approach to. So, you know, when you get really deep into the whole broadband development and very the technical issues, my thoughts are kind of running the other way. But still, I think there's a lot to learn about the microtasking and all of this. And we've been talking about a lot. We've been working with the Ministry of Labor on generation gaps and shifts in entrepreneurship and adjust. I think the better adjusting of labor is like a tie-in here. So, I can maybe give some comments a bit later on in the day.
Mm-hmm. Carlos?
Well, I just want to actually respond to what you were saying before about the model that we have here at Public Bank. Although I no longer work in public access, more of the People's Production House, but I've only been with PPH for about a week and a half, so I spent 5 years in Brooklyn Community Access Television. And And during that time, I mean, we actually had some legislation that was going to, was a threat to the work that we do in community television. So it certainly isn't a sustainable model if you're looking around the country at different access centers disappearing because of the state changing some of the ways that access centers are funded and run. So it is a precarious, tenuous relationship that we have with a cable company that's not making certainly any money from having free access stations. So I think that a big part of what we're doing at People's Production House is to look at access to media as a civic right. I mean, looking at it as something that's that we need to certainly regulate in a way that I think that does allow for businesses and for-profit companies to support, but it has to be something that there is some sort of shield wall or something to protect it, because it is if it's the whim of some of these large telecommunications companies, then we are it's always going to be a very precarious relationship. So it's something that I certainly don't have an answer for, but I think that we do have to look at different models that you were talking before about the domain name model. But it's something that we would have to always, have regulation that does allow it to be protected too. So that's something that,
Well, in the case what I was saying, it would be voluntary and it would be structural to our company to do that, because personally I believe in it. And I don't see that any of the other corporations are going to act that way. And so it's important.
But what you mentioned earlier about incentives, too. So I feel like if it's something in terms of, tax breaks or whatever that does allow it. So businesses do see this as something that, it's not just, public relations, although that's certainly a part of it. But it's something where they're...
Well, there's such a thing as philanthropy. And then also another element, which I didn't mention, which I'm very actually interested in understanding more, is the area of microfinance. And as a way of funding other types of entrepreneurial or community-based social enterprise works. Because there was a lot of success, and I'm interested to hear your take on it too, because it was very successful in Africa. And there are a lot of successful microfinance projects, Clinton Foundation or Kiva.org and all these other ones. And actually, in my business model for the domain registry, we set a portion of that, even as much as 10% of the profits aside for micro-lending, because it's actually a profitable business, but in a really good sense, not in the evil sense of profit, but for your profit, because also investing it back in the community gives all kinds of intangible results back, because, when people think about, what I have a problem with in the state and the governmental level when they cut budgets and they close down parks or they stop the library's hours or they reduce the number of police, that doesn't actually save money. That actually raises the cost, because what we have is an increase in crime and an increase in other types of social problems that really actually end up costing more than if we paid to keep the park open or if we paid to keep the library open, et cetera. So the bottom line cost isn't always the real cost. It's just like, for example, like the cost of drilling offshore. They think, okay, it's going to cost this much and whatever, but they didn't look at the unintended consequences of an environmental catastrophe. And what's the true cost of that, right? Or if people say that a gallon of gas is going to cost $3, the real cost of a gallon of gas is probably about $800 a gallon if you count the military efforts that it takes to protect our interests in oil. So it's not far-fetched when you really want to look at true costs. And so in my perspective as an entrepreneur, it makes sense to make these intangible investments back into the creative aspects of the community or into micro-lending, et cetera, et cetera. I think that the true profit isn't always measured in dollars and cents, but it's measured in social good.
I've got three points to make, mainly representing people that aren't here. The first one is the community fiber model, which, the idea of someone like Mount Hope you know, as I understand it, now everybody has Wi-Fi, but that all goes to one T1 provided by Verizon. You know, to go into your cooperative model of like, you know, why couldn't Mount Hope own its own infrastructure, or at least, you know, to own its own fiber and connectivity all the way to an IXP, and then at least just be buying. Then it comes down to your issue of, you know, how much you're paying for that middle mile and that access. And I would like to see, and I believe that this is where New York could lead the way, is in taking a block or something or a piece of public housing and creating the cooperative model to show that, you know, that people can own their own connectivity rather than being at the behest of whoever else.
Yeah, that's,
so that's
actually
the community fiber project, you know. And I have to say that Lou, you know, couldn't afford to keep going, couldn't get the finance, and has now got a well-paid job. So he's not going to be going forward. It's going to have, you know, someone else is going to have to do it. The second one is like, you know, this business to top level domains and applications. At a meeting just last week or 2 weeks ago, discussing the .nyc top level domain, there was an interesting proposal from Wikimedia NYC, and the models of saying that perhaps if you took the top level top level domain and dedicated it to local heritage wikis, so it would be like one whole Wikipedia for the city that would have, like they have different Wikipedias all over the world, you'd have a different one for every neighborhood, and where everybody could enter in all their little information about the history of their neighborhood and who went there, and you wouldn't have those same restrictions that you have on Wikipedia, although it would be community based, that, you know, so, I mean, delis could put in their specials of the week, anybody could put on whatever they want, you know, as a community thing, and so you would say no, that, you know, .nyc, that meant the wiki for New York, and that's the sole use of that top-level domain, you know, an application that everybody would get. And the third one, more controversial, is Teletruth Bruce Kushnick. Kushnick's mission in life is a whistleblower on the fact that the incumbents have had $320 billion in tax breaks over the past 20 years on the basis that they were going to build fiber for everybody and made promises which they have not delivered on, basically a bait and switch where they just said, gave everybody a DSL. And even so, they've been rolling out this Fios. The Fios is paid by Aunt Ethel's phone bill, which has gone from here to here. And now they're talking about rolling in extra money on a USF, which is all just going to get handed over again to the phone companies. And unless the communities stand up and say, look, you know, why don't we want this money? Don't give it to them. You know, so they've got to stand up. That's my 3 points.
Charlie. And you speak.
Congratulations. I've been waiting for somebody to raise that issue, not just all the incredible work that Bruce has been and his folks have been doing for years exposing them, but how important that USF money is going to be. If there's going to be new money, it's not going to be in the form of the standard old BTOP like we just went through. It's going to be USF, and we've got to be organized and involved in defining how that's going to be used and who's going to get access to it, and that's going to be the future.
So that means we've got to put together a very comprehensive community education plan and program.
Educate the community? That's heresy.
Chuck, how would you suggest you break down the political nepotism about the delegation of the universal service funds? I think this is the big point, that we know that they're available, but who gets them? This is always the question.
Chuck, that question was for you.
He's writing.
Chuck.
Yes.
That question was for you from Paul. Repeat it, Paul.
Repeat it, because your cell phone as a teleconferencing tool sucks, honey.
Yeah. How would you propose, how do you envision breaking the cycle of nepotism for the universal service funds going to the incumbent carriers, and opening that up to other, say, startups or other community-based infrastructure projects that could better apply those funds?
Sure. You know, just keep in mind that in addition to all the other stuff I was babbling about earlier, I'm a major policy wonk and somebody that is very engaged with what's going on in D.C. And so there's a whole policy side that this group needs to get very engaged in, whether it's with Congress or the FCC or state legislatures. But this community education piece that Bruce is just talking about is seriously going to need for us to get engaged in the policy process that's going on in D.C. There are a variety of folks, of course, the media reform folks, the free press, the MADCO's Media Democracy Coalition, the Benton Foundation, there are lots of people in D.C. that are already in the trenches dealing with this, and I really think that any discussion about advancing community broadband has to start, because of what's going on in D.C., with a major engagement in the policy battles that are happening.
What do you see the horizon for that being? Time horizon.
Now, there's no horizon. The sun's already up on it. You know, we've all been engaged in it for the last several months, and I know Charles Benton has been engaged in the whole push on the Universal Service Fund and moving that off of rural telephone to basically opening up for broadband. So we really need to engage Charles and various people like Beth McConnell from MADCO and various other people in D.C. With this group so that everybody understands what's going on and what's the timeline and where are the pressure points.
And as we were talking about earlier, it does seem there is a bias towards rural constituencies as opposed to urban in the USF as in some of the other funding. And I don't know, frankly, you know, how many people in Senate and the House, you know, representing major urban areas are on the right committees to push that. I think if you look at the makeup of the committees that govern the FCC, it's not very heavily concentrated at northeastern, urban, anything like that. So it's an uphill battle.
Clayton, you had...
I just wanted to ask a question, Bruce, to you, because I did come in late, but I just wanted to get a sense of both what the this coalition's, what your projected outcomes for this coalition are. Is it to put together a some sort of action document, or what was your vision of the outcome of this coalition?
That's a good question, and I guess it's kind of three-pronged. One is just to start this work in process and bring together this kind of working group. What I wanted to talk about after lunch was sort of how do we represent what this is on the web so that there's the ability for outsiders to blog and share with us. What's the multimedia presence that we want? Because I'm really into this idea of multimedia white papers, but also that it's collaborative, that it's multiple persons contributing to this, which is one reason why we're having this sort of structure today. But so what I want to do, you know, over the next two meetings is also bring in other practitioners such as Jabari Samama or Andrew Cohill or some other folks I'm talking to. Chuck about that would make sense to give a sense of what's going on nationally so we see how what we're talking about resonates with what's going on nationally. And then I know that we're actually working on a number of white papers trying to affect what's going on in Washington right now with the Center for Social Inclusion, and we're still strategizing about sort of a collaboration intra-Columbia that would generate some level of document that would potentially go to the FCC. But we're open for ideas, and that's part of what I wanted to do here is get people's ideas as to how we need to bring all this together, what we need to say, and each of you is best at talking to your particular constituency. And on one level, I also wanted to put together a document that structurally had very strong anecdotal support for why broadband is important because of the credibility of the practitioners. I don't think there's anything that we can crunch numbers-wise and talk about statistically. I think we have to do something that really speaks to...
City's report is going to come out any day soon.
Great, great, thanks. So that's just my thinking, but the idea is to get everyone's thinking, both here today and in an ongoing fashion over the next several months as we figure out what our online environment is.
Well, it's interesting because I think everyone has I think it was mentioned, you know, people have their independent agendas for whatever that is, whether it's private or public or do the right thing or make a lot of money. And what I would like to ultimately maybe even come out with today is what our common ground is. So we build that document you're talking about around that.
Great. Well, why don't we break for lunch? Let's go get some sandwiches and come back, and let's work on getting that done with the time remaining. And thank you, everyone. Chuck, we're going to...
Can you call me when you're ready for me next time?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.